Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, February 13th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Pat Steele, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Deanna Snyder. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Forecast for today, looking for a high of 47 with a mixture of clouds and sun. Winds will be light out of the east-northeast, 4 to 8 miles per hour. Tonight, we're expecting partly cloudy skies. Winds will be out of the southeast, 4 to 8 miles an hour, and we're expecting a low of 30. Tomorrow, cloudy and mild with a high of 53. And on Thursday, high of 39 and a low of 25, a little bit cooler on Thursday. Our normal high for this time of year is 35 degrees and normal low is 17, so we'll be well above that. Our record high today was set back in 1990 at 70 degrees and record low minus 21 in 1905. Sunrise today at 7:13 and sunsets tonight at 5:45 p.m. From the front page of the Des Moines Register, the third part of a story on financial sector in Des Moines, and the headline there is Success Stories. Other headlines include thousands of Iowa crime victims may lose service, and a study says that Polk County falls significantly short on aid to the homeless. From the Metro and Iowa section, the downtown Hy-Vee has quietly expanded its hours. Relatives recall a murder victim, and North Polk High School teacher celebrates 50 years. So that's a look at our weather and headlines, and now here is Deanna with her first story.
Thank you, Pat. Success stories. As Des Moines' financial sector slows, which firms are still growing? This is from Tyler Jett. It's the last in the series, it says. Athene President Grant Qualheim does not buy complaints about Iowa's tight labor market. He says employment grows when your business grows. People are saying we can't grow our business because we can't find the people. I fundamentally don't believe that. I don't believe that in Iowa, and I don't believe that in general. That may be news to rival executives and business lobbyists in the state who have long complained that Iowa's slow population growth has restrained corporate profits. Some have told the Register that Iowa's tight labor market is to blame for the Metro's loss of finance jobs since 2017, reversing a decades-long trend of rapid growth. Qualheim has a different take. You don't need people if you're not growing. Amid the finance industry's slowdown in the Metro, Athene is a bright light. A division of the private equity giant Apollo Global Management, it has expanded into the country's largest annuity provider since opening its U.S. headquarters in West Des Moines 11 years ago. From 2015 to 2022, according to financial filings, Athene's total annuity liability has grown from $56.2 billion to $161.3 billion. The metric is a sign of Athene's customer growth. Since 2017, Qualheim said the company has increased local headcount to 1,620 from 1,000. He said the company filled its office building at 7700 Mills Civic Parkway and that the executives are now renting extra space on Jordan Creek Parkway. Why wouldn't you want to join a company that's winning in the marketplace, becoming a market leader? He said. Athene's success underscores how much the Metro has come to rely on private equity firms over the last decade. In the wake of the 2007 to 2009 recession, companies such as Apollo have swarmed the life insurance and annuity market that dominates Des Moines' financial sector. These companies have found a steady source of revenue, which they invest in assets like real estate, private loans, and infrastructure projects. Traditional life insurers, in turn, found a way to escape the business, which grew slowly under their management. They usually invested money from customers into government and corporate bonds, earning a profit on the spread between what they owed and what the bonds paid. As the Federal Reserve kept interest rates near zero in the wake of the recession, life insurers struggled to earn profits. Des Moines' Principal Financial Group was one such company, exiting the individual life and some annuities businesses in 2021. Private equity firms' life and annuity assets increased from $50 billion in 2012 to $724 billion in 2022, according to the ratings agency AM Best. Their market share increased to 9% from 1% during that time. Private equity-backed insurers also have taken over pensions from traditional providers, including Lockheed Martin Corp. and Alcoa Corp. Locally, in 2021, KKR and Company bought a majority stake of the Global Atlantic Financial Group, which operates an office in the Davis-Brown Tower at 215 10th Street downtown. KKR bought the rest of the company last month. Blackstone and Des Moines-based F&G reached an agreement for the investment firm to manage the insurer's assets in 2017. Brookfield Asset Management, meanwhile, reached an agreement to buy West Des Moines' American Equity Investment Life Insurance Company last July. The deal has not closed, and a Brookfield spokesperson turned down the Register's interview request. But in an investor presentation in September, Brookfield Insurance Solutions CEO Sachin Shah said the company plans to grow its annuity assets to about $250 billion from $100 billion. "We're going to be one of the top leaders in the market," he said. While local financial activities job growth has slowed, the Des Moines Metro is still dense with the kinds of experts that insurers need. As of 2022, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, no metro in the country had more insurance underwriters, financial examiners, or financial risk specialists per capita. The metro ranked third in actuaries per capita behind Bloomington, Illinois, and Hartford, Connecticut. Qualheim said Apollo centered its U.S. insurance operations in the metro because of that talent base and the state's regulators. He said Iowa Insurance Division employees approve Athene's applications in a matter of days or weeks, while those in other states take up to a year. He said regulators in other states make unreasonable demands as Athene expanded after its formation in 2009. He declined to discuss specific problems, but New York's regulators investigated private equity firms amid Athene's rise. In 2013, the year Athene entered the Iowa market with its $2.6 billion acquisition of Aviva USA, the New York Department of Financial Services subpoenaed several private equity firms to obtain emails, investor pitch books, and other material to see whether the companies enriched themselves at consumers' expense. The subpoenas did not lead to an enforcement action, but that same year, the regulators published a report on shadow insurers, firms known as captives that enter reinsurance agreements with sister companies. The captives are often based offshore or in U.S. states with light regulations, and the main insurance firms unload policies to the captives. The main firms appear to have less risk, allowing them to write more policies. The captives are often in regions that don't require them to publicly disclose their audited financial reports. Athene has long reinsured its own policies in Vermont and Bermuda-based subsidiaries. Athene and New York regulators butted heads again in 2018 when the state fined an Athene subsidiary $15 million for failing to provide required information to life insurance policyholders. Athene had contracted that work to another company, according to the Wall Street Journal, but the regulators held Athene responsible. The state also fined Athene $45 million in 2020 after an unlicensed subsidiary allegedly conducted insurance business in New York. In Iowa, Qualheim said the company built a strong relationship with state leaders. After announcing its purchase of Aviva USA, Qualheim and Athene founder Jim Belardi met with then-Governor Terry Branstad and Iowa Economic Development Authority Director Debbie Durham. Qualheim said Branstad congratulated Athene on the acquisition and asked what help the company needed from state leaders. "We were just very impressed," he said. "That initial impression has proved out to be true." Athene's growth is in step with the general expansion of private equity firms throughout the U.S. According to PitchBook, total assets held by private equity firms increased from $1.5 trillion in 2008 to $8 trillion last year. The firms increasingly own real estate, invest in infrastructure, and offer private loans. Critics have warned that compared with loans from regulated banks, private lending markets are opaque and difficult to value. Leaders at Athene and Apollo have frequently rebuffed such criticism. An Apollo spokesperson told the Wall Street Journal in 2022 that 95% of the company's fixed income portfolio consists of investment-grade or safe assets. A review by AM Best found that private equity-linked insurance and annuities companies generally invest in riskier assets than their traditional counterparts. At the same time, AM Best also reported that the newcomers tend to hold more money in reserve, a sign that the companies are being prudent. Qualheim said, "Some have tried to characterize our strategy as riskier. We think it's appropriate, given the liability structure that we have." Unlike some local companies that have allowed employees to work from home, Athene requires workers to report to the office 4 days a week. Qualheim said, "Local employees see opportunities to advance their careers at Athene." When you're a business of rapid growth and you're promoting from within, as opposed to a company that is not even growing, or your business is shrinking, that's pretty obvious, he said. In 2013, the same year Athene closed its deal for Aviva USA, F&G announced that it would move its headquarters from Baltimore to Des Moines. Then CEO Lee Launer told the Register at the time that the company targeted the metro for its deep talent pool and its sophisticated regulatory approach. A company spokesperson pointed out that many other annuity providers were in the area, indicating that Iowa regulators would understand the ins and outs of the business. At the time, the company planned to add 50 employees in Iowa by 2016. F&G had been on a much faster expansion plan in recent years. Chen Chu, a more former Blackstone private equity executive, bought F&G in 2017 through one of his companies, CF Corp. At the same time, F&G reached a deal for Blackstone to manage its assets in return for a fee. Fidelity National Financial, a title insurance company, bought F&G in 2020, but the Blackstone management deal remains in place. According to an investor presentation, Blackstone is investing F&G's money in private loans, bonds, infrastructure projects, commercial real estate, and airplanes. F&G CEO Chris Blunt said of Blackstone, "We had a 400-pound big brother on the playground." From 2018 to 2022, F&G's balance increased from $26.7 billion in assets to $43.6 billion. In 2019, the company announced it would move from an office at 2 Ruan Center to a new space at 801 Grand. F&G estimated that the relocation would cost $9.4 million and would increase its footprint from about 50,000 square feet to 83,000 square feet. Blunt recently told the Register that local employment is up. Since he joined the company in December of 2018, he said, F&G has hired about 450 Des Moines-based workers, bringing the total local headcount to about 650. At the same time, he estimated that the company hired 400 more employees in other parts of the country. Blunt said the company couldn't find all the employees it needed locally as it scaled up quickly, so it looked elsewhere for investment professionals. He said, "There's just a limit to how many people you can pull out of your competitors." Unlike Qualheim, Blunt says he does think Iowa's tighter labor market presents some challenges, and F&G allows employees to work remotely, unlike Athene. But Blunt said many workers do come into the office, particularly when company leaders want to address the staff. He also is optimistic that local companies will reverse recent struggles in Des Moines' financial labor market. He said, "You're going to see that line of annual job growth, at least on the insurance portion, turn back positive." Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Elsewhere from the front page Des Moines Register, the study finds that Polk County falls significantly short on aid to the homeless. Virginia Barreda of the Register wrote this article. Polk County needs about three times the funding it currently gives to housing, emergency shelter, and other resources for people experiencing homelessness, a new study says. The homeless system needs assessment and centralized intake evaluation, published on February 7th, says the resources for people experiencing homelessness fall significantly short of the community's needs and identifies necessary improvements. The study shows the county needs hundreds of additional shelter spaces and housing units, according to a release from Homeward, Polk County's homelessness planning organization. It says filling that gap would require roughly an additional $20 million. Columbus, Ohio-based Housing Innovations, a homeless training and technical assistance firm, conducted the study with funding from the Nationwide Foundation. Homeward Executive Director Angie Arthur told the Des Moines Register the study offers concrete, solid data to demonstrate the need in the community and also provides a roadmap for where the community should invest its resources to help alleviate homelessness. In addition, it underscores that local homeless service providers don't have the resources to tackle the crisis and will need investment from other community sources to provide more affordable housing, Arthur said. She added, "It will take the intention and investment of our community businesses, county and city government, and philanthropy to help us develop the resources to increase affordable housing, particularly as we see increasing number of families experiencing homelessness in the metro." A January 2023 point-in-time count found 644 homeless people in Polk County, and that's a slight jump from the 606 recorded in 2022 and the 576 documented in 2021. A requirement of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the point-in-time count, or PIT for short, is held every January and July in the county and serves as a snapshot of homeless people's experiences, living situations, and the resources available for them. Leaders said at the time that data showed the number of people experiencing homelessness was steadily rising to pre-pandemic levels. Results from the latest January PIT count are not yet available. And here are key points of the report. More emergency shelter space for families, permanent housing for adults are among the top priorities. After meetings with community stakeholders in November and December, the firm identified three immediate steps for improving Polk County's homelessness response system. First, Polk County needs 29 emergency shelter units for families to meet rising need since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. As many as 100 families were on the emergency shelter wait list last summer, an unprecedented number. Point number two, less than 5% of single adults eligible for rapid rehousing or permanent supportive housing programs in 2023 got it. This lack of housing opportunities increases unsheltered homelessness and contributes to larger homeless encampments throughout the Des Moines metro area. And finally, housing-focused case management is needed for people experiencing homelessness. It provides one-on-one assistance to homeless families and individuals so they can find short and long-term solutions, such as reuniting with friends or family, shared housing, and low-cost and permanent housing. There's a need to expand emergency shelter space and permanent housing units. Here's the amount of housing and shelter slots Polk County needs to add to keep up with the influx of people experiencing homelessness in the community, according to the study. 43 slots for homelessness prevention, a program that offers financial assistance and housing resource coordination. 48 units of emergency shelter, short-term crisis housing, with a focus on assessing housing needs. The average stay is 60 days for singles, 120 days for families. 43 slots for diversion, rapid exit, a rapid resolution of housing crisis during short shelter stays. 333 slots for rapid rehousing, permanent housing with transitional subsidies, and on-site services targeted to higher need households to maintain housing after temporary assistance ends. There's an average 12-month enrollment period, but it's available up to 24 months. 523 units for permanent supportive housing, project-based or scattered-site permanent housing linked with supportive services that help people maintain housing. It's targeted at people with significant barriers to self-sufficiency. There are no limits on how long stays can last. To serve families, 6 homelessness prevention slots, 6 diversion rapid exit slots, 29 emergency shelter units, 4 rapid rehousing slots, and 17 permanent supportive housing units. Polk County needs 3 times the amount of money currently allocated to homeless services. To add this capacity, Polk County needs to come up with an estimated $19.7 million more annually for housing and other resources, according to the study. Currently, the City of Des Moines and Homeward allocates more than $6 million in annual funding for the Des Moines-Polk County homelessness system. That funding comes through federal resources, including the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Continuum of Care Competition Grant Awards, Emergency Solutions Grants, and Community Development Block Grants, according to the study. Private foundations and philanthropies also provide funding. The report also found that while the county's centralized intake process, the main referral source for many housing programs in the community, is largely compliant with HUD requirements, it needs updating. Provided by primary health care, centralized intake is often called the front door for people experiencing homelessness in Polk County. A 30 to 40 question screening tool is the foundation of the health center's centralized intake process and ask clients to share personal information such as their annual income, how long they have been unsheltered, detailed history of mental illness or substance abuse, and whether they are victims of domestic violence. Staff issue referrals for clients based on their needs, which are measured by a vulnerability index. Only 20% of the more than 3,000 households that experienced homelessness in Des Moines receive rapid rehousing or permanent supportive housing referrals, the study says. PHC has said that there are not enough openings and programs to serve everyone who experiences homelessness. According to the study, refocusing centralized intake to meet the needs of people ineligible for those programs will be more holistic and client-centered and simultaneously contribute to greater system efficiency and impact. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, thousands of Iowa crime victims may lose services. Congress is poised to okay a 40% cut in funding. This is from Michaela Ram of Des Moines Register. Iowa agencies that provide support and services to victims of violent crimes say a proposed $5.4 million reduction in the state's federal funding under consideration in Congress could cut off help to more than 20,000 Iowans. More than a dozen organizations across the state offer assistance to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, homicide, and other violent crimes. Their services range from helping victims find low-income housing to preparing for court appearances to assisting them in filling out applications for jobs or assistance programs. To offer these direct services to clients, these nonprofit agencies rely heavily on a fund established under the Federal Victims of Crime Act, or VOCA, V-O-C-A. But Congress is currently considering a more than 40% cut to VOCA funds for the 2024 fiscal year, dropping the proposed allocation to $1.2 billion from $1.9 billion. Budget the previous fiscal year, including a roughly $5 million loss for Iowa. Iowa Attorney General Brenda Byrd has signed a letter alongside 41 other state attorneys general calling on Congress to provide short-term bridge funding to VOCA. stating those agency services are critical to maintain. She said, "We must prevent victims from being victimized twice," in a prepared statement Wednesday. She said, "Victims have already been through enough. We're calling on Congress to provide bridge funding to ensure victims and survivors receive the support they deserve." Without the funding, Iowa agencies would be forced to cut staffing and operations, meaning victims of crimes in Iowa would lose access to critical services, said Lindsay Pingle, director of community engagement at the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence. In fact, the coalition estimates that 22,386 crime victims could lose access to services without that federal funding. Pingle said, "Every agency that's supposed to be providing various services to support survivors, we are all on incredibly tight budgets right now. So trying to serve every survivor with everything they need is just getting harder and harder." So why is Congress considering a deep cut to VOCA? The VOCA Fund, which was established in 1984, collect fines or other financial penalties from those who have received federal convictions. Those dollars are then provided as grants to states to support victims of any and all violent crimes. The fund does not use any taxpayer dollars. Pingle said it is the largest pot of money that most states receive to do this work. Funding to VOCA has been dwindling in recent years, in part because of a change in federal prosecution strategies, according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. In recent years, advocates say there's been an increase in deferred settlements and non-prosecution agreements in federal trials, meaning dollars from those settlements aren't deposited into the VOCA fund because they technically aren't criminal prosecutions, the National Coalition says. Congress did approve legislation in 2021 that provided a stopgap in funding, allowing VOCA to sustain itself for another few years. However, it was only a temporary fix, only providing enough funding to sustain the fund through the current fiscal year. Pingle said, "We always knew it was a temporary fix, and Congress has known it is a temporary fix also." The fund is not able to sustain itself at its current level, meaning the projected 2024 fiscal year is $700 million less than the current fiscal year, or roughly a 40% cut. So how does the VOCA funding cut affect Iowa? The Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence and the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault say 26 local agencies in Iowa would be impacted by a cut to VOCA grants. Last year, those agencies served nearly 56,000 Iowans who were victims of crimes. These agencies received $13.1 million from VOCA last fiscal year. I'm sorry. According to the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Brenna Byrd and other states' attorneys general said in their letter to congressional leadership that a cut to VOCA funding could result in a closure of crime victim service agencies nationwide, leaving victims without services and endangering their safety and well-being. The letter also points out that victims are often key witnesses in criminal proceedings against the offender, and that a lack of services for victims may impact our state's abilities to hold offenders accountable and thereby undermine public safety. The letter states, "Congressionally authorized bridge funding could provide stability to crime victims and victim service providers and avoid harm to public safety." Among those agencies in Iowa facing a potential impact is LUNA, L-U-N-A, which is Latina Unidas por un Nuevo, which specializes in helping Latin populations in Iowa. Staff at the statewide organization, which has offices in Des Moines and Marshalltown, often serve as translators or as a critical connection for Latin victims to access low-income housing and other support, said Melissa Canozalea, who is the organization's executive director. However, the organization's budget is stretched thin, and it's already been challenged for the organization's seven staff members to meet all the need they see across Iowa, said Canozalea. Without that funding, the organization would likely have to cut staff and reduce its operations. Zelaya said, "The question for policymakers becomes, which victims do we stop serving, and what services do we stop providing?" Pingel said Iowans who would feel the most impact are those who already disproportionately struggle to access service. That includes those who live in rural communities where there's little support and other basic programming. So why do advocates say an increase in state funding may not be enough to meet the need? In light of these pending federal funding cuts, the Iowa Attorney General's office has requested an additional $5.4 million from state lawmakers for crime victim services. However, Pingel said Byrd's office has stated that request for additional allocation will only be made if VOCA funding to Iowa is reduced. If approved, that $5.4 million would be in addition to the roughly $5 million that Iowa already provides every fiscal year to local crime victim service agencies, which is administered through the Attorney General's office. Pingel said this looming cut in federal funding comes as advocates have been calling on state lawmakers and other officials for increased state funding. The Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence and the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault have been calling on the Iowa legislature to approve a total of $10 million in state funding for crime and victim services. However, Pingel said, advocates' requests have not been answered, and state funding for crime victim services has remained at $5 million for the past decade. This has created its own challenges, particularly as demand for services from local agencies has continued to rise in recent years. Costs to provide these services have been on the rise, but federal and state funding sources have not kept up, Pingel said. Pingel said her organization is continuing to call on state lawmakers to approve additional funding for crime victim service agencies, saying looming federal funding costs has made it more critical than ever that they receive additional support. She said state and federal dollars have to work together in order to support survivors. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. We'll continue with our Iowa news by switching now to the Metro and Iowa section. Our top story here is downtown Hy-Vee quietly expands hours. After a blowback, the store is now open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Philip Jones and Addison Lathers wrote this article. Hy-Vee has quietly changed the hours of its downtown Des Moines store to 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., partially backtracking from a previous cut in hours to 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., that drew blowback from the city and groups representing downtown residents and businesses. The store previously had been open from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., and city officials said the dramatic reduction in hours, which Hy-Vee instituted on February 5th, without informing the city, violated a 2015 development agreement. Asked Friday about the apparent 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. revision reported on social media sites, Hy-Vee spokesperson Tina Potthoff declined to confirm it and would only say that the company was continuing to hold conversations with the city. A Des Moines Register reporter, however, visited the store and made purchases shortly before 7 p.m. on Sunday and shortly after 7 a.m. on Monday. As of Monday afternoon, the store's website still listed the 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. hours, and there was no updated signage on any of its doors Sunday evening or Monday morning. Deputy City Manager Matt Anderson told the Register that the latest change has not been made in consultation with the city, but may have resulted from discussions between Hy-Vee and Knapp Properties, the developer of the 420 Court Avenue building that houses the store. Anderson said in an emailed statement, "They have not presented their recommendation to us yet. Any proposed changes, which are inconsistent with the existing agreement, including ours, will be presented for City Council consideration in the form of a development agreement amendment at a later date." Knapp Properties did not respond to requests for comment. The agreement, which provided millions of dollars in subsidies for the store's construction at 420 Court Avenue, calls for it to be open from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. The city previously had allowed Hy-Vee to dial back the closing time for the store, which opened in 2017, by a few hours, apparently in response to decreased traffic during the COVID-19 pandemic. After the abrupt changes in hours February 5th, Potthoff told the Register it had been made because of decreased foot traffic and an increase in theft and loitering at the store. She said the store had made more than 200 calls to police over 6 months and that reducing its hours was intended to safeguard customers and employees. City leaders pushed back, especially on the assertion about rising crime, and warned the West Des Moines-based grocer it risks violating the development agreement. The deal intended to support the rapid growth of downtown's round-the-clock population included 15 years of tax increment financing for the project, with Knapp collecting nearly $1.5 million so far. The developer also was able to acquire the city-owned site, formerly a parking lot, for a fraction of its assessed value. Speaking after the February 5th change in hours, Anderson warned that Hy-Vee had 45 days to return its hours to 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., or the company and Knapp could be found in violation of the agreement. Des Moines City Council member Josh Mandelbaum, whose Ward 3 includes the Central Business District, said Monday that the revised hours are a step in the right direction, but I still have concerns that I have shared with city staff and will continue to have conversations about. The store appeared to have fewer than 10 customers shopping Sunday evening after 6 p.m. and even fewer Monday morning before 8 a.m. Deanna?
North Polk High School teacher celebrates 50 years. Computer science and financial literacy instructor also drives the bus. This is written by Chris Higgins of the Des Moines Register. Bruce Bennett had a question for his barber, who's been cutting hair for a while now. When are you going to give this up? The barber, who's a little bit older than him, said, I've got too many friends. They're retired and they're dead. Likewise, Bennett, a computer science and financial literacy teacher at North Polk High School in Alleman, hasn't retired. At age 72, he's celebrating 50 years as a teacher in North Polk. The achievement coincides with his 50th wedding anniversary and 50th year as a certified wrestling official. 50 years in the same school district is a heck of an accomplishment, said Superintendent Michael Klein. And everyone hopes for 10 more years with the man they know as Mr. Bennett. Some of his former students have even returned to teach at North Polk. Bennett said, It doesn't feel any different than any other day. I just feel fortunate to be able to come up here and they let me in the building. Bennett, who is 72, is from Algona and wrestled for his high school's successful team. He said, A down year is when we got second in state. We were depressed. His name regularly appeared in the Kossuth County Advance during his wrestling career, and he was a state champion in 1969. That led to a scholarship to wrestle at Louisiana State University, along with two of his classmates. The Advance reported in 1972 about Bennett and eight other former wrestlers using the Algona High School practice room for workouts while they were home from college. The article credited Bennett and his fellow Algonans, Larry Taylor and Phil Bode, with helping the LSU wrestling program through its growing pains and into an upward movement with their aggressive, exciting style. While at LSU, Bennett got to see the famous Pistol Pete Maravich, who played basketball for the Tigers and holds the all-time record for scoring in Division I college basketball, 3,667 points. Bennett said we would pause practice and watch him warm up because it was incredible. Bennett even saw Pistol Pete score 60 points in one game before there was a three-point line. He's now part of a rare club of fans who has gotten to see both Maravich and current Iowa Hawkeyes guard Caitlin Clark, who could surpass Pistol Pete's record on their home courts. Bennett taught math earlier in his career and has coached wrestling and other sports. After LSU, he started his teaching career in Kanawha, south of Britt in northern Iowa. Later, he interviewed at North Polk. At the time, the district was less centralized, and there were even elementary schools in Elkhart and Sheldahl, Bennett said. About 40% of North Polk's students lived on farms then. Now that number is about 5% in the rapidly growing and suburbanizing district. During the interview, Bennett got the chance to visit the high school's kitchen, where there were hot rolls with honey butter to start the day. It was a selling point that kicked off his half-century tenure with North Polk. Bennett eventually looked to get his master's degree, and a friend told him computer science was where it was at. He earned his degree over 3 summers at Northwest Missouri State in the mid-1980s and soon began teaching programming. North Polk received a federal Department of Energy grant to bring the internet to the district via an Ames laboratory connection, making North Polk one of the first smaller districts in Iowa to go online. Bennett's classroom was next to the media center, and he made a deal with the librarian, who had the only phone in that part of the building. She got access to the internet in exchange for access to her phone, which was necessary for an internet connection at the time. His students started competing in programming contests and winning national honors. The school board eventually told Bennett he couldn't keep students in the computer lab past 10 p.m. after they were done with their other activities. In 1997, Des Moines Register article featured North Polk's computer program and the high school's expanding website. Dozens of students had their own homepages, which featured bouncing basketball gifts and photos of their now vintage cars. Autumn Aronson announced on her page that she intended to marry actor Jean-Claude Van Damme, while Stacy Kellogg professed to her obsession with Scooby-Doo. Renee Harry, the declared mayor of Funky Town, loved frogs, while Mike Shores asked anyone who didn't like country star George Strait to leave his page. Patricia Moore, the media center director at the time, contributed a link for students to check library catalogs through the Des Moines Metro, while webmaster and freshman Omar Tesdell contributed weekly lunch menus and coordinated website content. The site won national awards. The 1997 North Polk site is archived on the Wayback Machine site. Bennett's computer science students receive honors every year to this day, one of his proudest accomplishments as a teacher. Bennett also is known at North Polk for escorting the senior class trips to Washington, D.C., since starting in the 1970s as a chaperone. I've had the pleasure of chaperoning this trip with Mr. Bennett, and it's amazing how much fun the students have with him and how he connects with them, said North Polk principal Seth Poldberg. He added that Bennett is an incredible educator who has impacted countless student lives in his 50 years with North Polk. Bennett also drives a bus route for the district, helping out during a time of driver shortages. A Des Moines Register photographer recently rode along, and lots of students made sure to thank Bennett before they got off the bus. "He's a man that wears many hats," said Klein. Ultimately, he said, Bennett is a cheerleader for his students and creates memories for them. Poldberg said, Mr. Bennett is an incredible educator who has impacted countless students' lives over the past 50 years at North Polk. Pat.
That's a nice story. Elsewhere from the Metro and Iowa section, relatives recall murder victim, shooter sentenced to life in prison in 2023 case. William Morse of the Register wrote this article. Deanna Burks doesn't want to remember her grandson, Russell McKeon Jr., as he died, but for how he lived. McKeon, age 45, was shot and killed in January 2023 at a Fleur Drive hotel. Surfer Bones, with whom he was staying, was found guilty of his murder and on Friday was sentenced to life in prison. Burks, whose statement was read in court by prosecutor Kevin Bell, said that what matters about Rusty McKeon was his love for his family, his friends, and life. I want to remember and think about his love for the Pittsburgh Steelers and eating food I had prepared for him, she wrote. Others who spoke at Friday's hearing recalled McKeon as the life of a party, his importance to his 5 children, and how his loss devastated his mother, who died of cancer just months after her son's killing. His 16-year-old daughter said she longs to hear him respond when she speaks to him while visiting his grave, and that he'll never know how hard I try to make him proud. McKeon struggled in his final years. His family spoke of his battle with addiction and was on the verge of homelessness when he wound up sharing Bones' hotel room. At his trial in November, prosecutors said Bones repeatedly called police trying to get McKeon evicted and alleged that he shot McKeon twice in the head while he slept on January 13, 2023. Bones filed a motion seeking a new trial, maintaining his innocence and accusing his attorneys of various failings before and during the trial. Judge Paul Scott rejected his claim that the verdict was contrary to the weight of the evidence. He told Bones, "I don't believe that the verdict is incorrect. I don't think this is a close call. I do, in fact, think the evidence was overwhelming." Bones briefly addressed the court before his sentencing, saying of McKeon's family that, "I'm sorry for the loss, whatever, and I didn't do this." Defense attorney Wendy Samuelson declined to comment after the hearing. In addition to the mandatory sentence of life without parole, Bones also was ordered to pay $150,000 in restitution to McKeon's estate, as required under Iowa law. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. Migrant workers ask Iowa lawmakers to reject immigration bills as threat to state's economy. This is from Galen Carrier of the Des Moines Register. Immigrants and refugee workers urged Iowa lawmakers Monday to stop advancing a slate of bills they called anti-immigration and harmful to the state workforce. The bills under consideration would require Iowa businesses to use the federal E-Verify program to screen and block undocumented workers, criminalize re-entering Iowa after being previously deported from the U.S., make it a felony to encourage or induce a person to enter the U.S. illegally, and require proof of citizenship or lawful residence to receive in-state college tuition. The workers traveled to the capital with Asuka Mivos, Iowa, which is an Iowa City-based immigrant rights group. Ruby Cacheris, who arrived in Iowa 18 months ago on a work permit, works in a factory packaging personal hygiene products and worked as a chemistry teacher in Venezuela. She said the proposed legislation would hurt industries core to Iowa's economy, including meatpacking plants and construction. "Why are we going to harm the migrant community if migrants are a hardworking labor force in this state?" she said. She estimated that 90% of her colleagues are immigrants. And Clinton Dimambu, a college student who immigrated from the Democratic Republic of Congo, urged legislators to consider those who fled to the U.S. to escape persecution and conflict. He said, "When you are making laws, you have to think about the refugees who left their country because of genocide and wars supported by the United States." The Reverend Guillermo Trevino, a pastor in West Liberty and Columbus Junction and co-director of the group, called the bills not an efficient use of our resources. He says, "We're already struggling to keep people here." All but one of the bills opposed by advocates Monday have advanced through subcommittees, and a version of the bill requiring business use E-Verify has been passed out of committee. The proposal regulating in-state tuition has not yet received a hearing. This session's slate of bills and their opposition comes as federal immigration policy continues to be scrutinized in Washington and across the U.S. Republicans backing the proposals have touted them as necessary for security as they urge President Joe Biden's administration to amp up control and policing at the southern border. Governor Kim Reynolds, who visited Eagle Pass, Texas recently as she urged Biden to combat illegal immigration, has prepared to send more Iowa National Guard soldiers and Iowa State Patrol officers to the border. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. And our final story from the Metro Iowa section, SX Dowling teacher pleads guilty to sexual exploitation. Jose Mendiola of the Register wrote this article. A former Dowling Catholic High School teacher who was arrested in 2023 in connection with a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old student has pleaded guilty to sexual exploitation by a school employee and faces up to 2 years in prison, according to court documents. Police arrested Kristen Gant, age 36, in April. Gant entered her plea on February 8th, the court documents show. In court records, she admitted to kissing a student under the age of 18 for the purpose of sexual arousal while she was an English teacher at Dowling. A criminal complaint stated Gant admitted to police that she engaged in a romantic relationship with the student that involved physical intimacy on at least 5 occasions. Each of the physical encounters occurred in Gant's classroom after the school day had ended, according to the complaint. A search warrant application filed prior to Gant's arrest showed police obtained email in Instagram messages between her and the student that appeared personal and flirtatious in nature. Some of the conversations on Instagram, which the warrant application said were first obtained by WHO-TV, detail messages in which they comment on each other's appearance and make plans to spend time together outside school. According to the warrant, the student told police Gant had reached out to provide support as he struggled with family issues at home. The student denied having a physical relationship with Gant or contact with her outside school. According to the warrant, school administrators supplied police with surveillance footage that appeared to show Gant and the student in a classroom alone behind a locked door. The window on the door is shown to be covered by a piece of paper, according to the warrant. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. Okay, on page 2 of the main section, President Biden's advisors admit mistakes in Gaza. Officials apologize to Arab Americans over the war. This is written by Niraj Waralku, Todd Spangler, and Michael Collins of USA Today. Dateline, Dearborn, Michigan. Senior advisors to President Joe Biden admitted mistakes and apologized privately to Arab Americans in Michigan for the way the administration has handled the war in Gaza and for how it has spoken publicly about Palestinians during the deadly conflict with Israel. Biden on Thursday dispatched several of his top aides to Dearborn, the U.S. city with the highest percentage of Arab Americans, for a series of private meetings and discussions about the Israel-Hamas war with politicians, community advocates, and faith leaders. Ali Dagher, a Dearborn attorney who attended one of the meetings, said Deputy National Security Advisor Jonathan Feiner apologized for how the Biden administration at times has talked about Palestinians. Dagher said, Joe Feiner specifically apologized for the language being used. He apologized for the administration's failure to stop the dehumanizing of Palestinians. He apologized for how the president has talked about the Palestinians. Abbas Alwaya, a Dearborn activist who also attended one of the meetings, said the officials admitted mistakes and missteps in the administration's response to the conflict. But Alwaya, who is one of the leaders of a campaign encouraging Michigan residents to vote uncommitted in next week's Democratic primary instead of casting their votes for Biden, said the administration's mea culpa rang hollow. He said the president's refusal to change course or even publicly acknowledge his mistakes is a grave insult to people here in Michigan. To Michigan Democrats in particular, he said. The hypocrisy of telling us privately that the administration has made mistakes while continuing to fail to hold Benjamin Netanyahu accountable publicly, it's a blatant display of moral bankruptcy that we will have political consequences here in Michigan. The meetings came as Biden faces mounting anger from Arab Americans, a key voting bloc in the swing state of Michigan, leading into this year's presidential election. Arab, Muslim, and progressive groups are demanding that Biden call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and have put him on notice that he will no longer get their vote. Dearborn Mayor Abdullah Hamoud has been hammering the Biden administration for months on the war. He declined a meeting last month with Biden's campaign manager, saying the administration should be sending policymakers to Dearborn, not campaign officials. On Thursday, Hamoud hosted one of the meetings with Biden's senior advisors at Dearborn City Hall. Hamoud said his message was heard, and this time the officials in attendance were those who focus on foreign policy issues, not elections. Hamoud said this meeting was held to ensure that the White House and those with the ability to change the course of the genocide unfolding in Gaza very clearly hear and understand the demands of our community, directly from us. He said this in a statement after the meeting. We remained uncompromising in our values and our demands for a permanent ceasefire, ending unrestricted military support to the State of Israel, and expediting humanitarian aid and funding to UNRWA, among others. He was referring to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East. After the meeting with Hamoud, Biden officials held a meeting with Palestinian Americans and a meeting with other elected officials that included Detroit Mayor Mike Dugan and Wayne County Circuit Judge Maryam Bazzi, among others. A fourth meeting included two leaders in Detroit's African-American Muslim community and Osama Siblani, publisher of the Arab American News. Siblani said he conveyed 7 points to the officials. The points included a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Yemen, and other areas, the release of all hostages and prisoners on both sides, assistance for Palestinians to rebuild their lives, a resumption of aid to UNRWA, and tangible steps to create a Palestinian state. He said, "Our community is rightfully angry and will not accept future engagements or dialogues with this administration unless and until an immediate ceasefire is implemented." The Biden advisors who attended the meetings included Samantha Power, the head of U.S. Agency for International Development and author of an influential book called A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Some Arab American advocates have criticized Power for her stance on what they describe as a genocide currently taking place in Gaza. The U.S. recently suspended funding to UNRWA amid accusations that some of its members were linked to terrorism. Power said the U.S. will not be abandoning UNRWA. They're waiting for UNRWA to complete its investigation. Other Biden administration attendees included Steve Benjamin, senior advisor and director of the Office of Public Engagement, and also Tom Perez, senior advisor to Biden and director of the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, and Dan Cole, director of the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, and Mazen Bazrawi, National Security Council Director for Partnerships and Global Engagement. While the group met, about 50 protesters gathered outside the Henry Hotel in Dearborn, many wearing black and white keffiyehs and waving Palestinian flags. Chants broke out among the crowd, including "Stop the genocide" and "Cease fire now." A handful of police gathered nearby, as did hotel staff. The protests remained peaceful. Ali Sob of Dearborn, age 22, was among the protesters. "If you have any ounce of empathy, you can feel for the Palestinian people," Sob said. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Elsewhere from the secretary back in hospital transfers powers, Tom Vandenbroek of USA Today wrote this article on Dateline is Washington. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was rushed to the hospital Sunday for symptoms of an emergent bladder issue less than 1 month after his previous secret stay at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center sparked controversy. Austin, age 70, was taken back to Walter Reed by his security detail at 2:20 p.m. Sunday, according to Air Force Major General Pat Ryder, the Pentagon press secretary. Just before 5 p.m., he transferred his authority to Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks. He remained at the hospital Sunday evening, Ryder said. Unlike his previous hospitalizations that began January 1st, Austin notified the White House, Congress, and Pentagon officials, Ryder said in a statement. Earlier Sunday, Ryder said that Austin had retained his authority, noting that he had the secret communication systems necessary to perform his duties. Austin was taken by ambulance to Walter Reed on January 1st after complaining of severe pain. He had developed complications from surgery for prostate cancer on December 22nd. According to his doctors, Austin failed to notify the White House, Congress, and key staffers at the Pentagon of his diagnosis. Austin's staff sought to keep his ambulance ride under the radar as well, according to the transcript of the 9/11 call obtained by USA Today. A staff member asked the dispatcher to approach his house in the Northern Virginia suburbs without sirens or flashing lights to keep it subtle. Doctors at Walter Reed placed him in intensive care for 4 days, a fact that Austin kept secret. He eventually transferred his authority to Hicks. Austin, at a February 1st news conference, apologized for trying to conceal his illness and subsequent hospitalization. He called the diagnosis a gut punch and said his instinct was to keep his illness private. He said that he took full responsibility for the mistake and added that he had not pressured his staff to withhold details. Pentagon officials recently completed a review of its policy regarding transfer of authority, Ryder said last week. Austin is reviewing that report before its release. In addition, the Pentagon Inspector General is investigating the matter, and Congress has called on Austin to testify about it.